You're listening to KHSU Thursday Night Talk is coming right up. Linda Stansberry is our host this week. As always, we welcome your contributions. Give us a call at 826-4805 if you're out of the area at 826. Linda will get that number to you actually. And we are accepting text messages at 492-KHSU. Now over to Linda.
Hi, good evening. My name's Linda Stansberry. I'm your host tonight on Thursday Night Talk. Thank you all for joining us. Those numbers to call in are 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. You can also text us at 492-KHSU. And tonight I have James Falk and Neil Tarpey. They are both local writers. Neil Tarpey recently released a book, Flashes of Lightning, and with illustrations by my friend Laura Zerzan Jones. They're amazing. So welcome, guys.
Thanks, Linda. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Linda. Thanks for having us in.
Excellent. Well, I went to your guys' readings a couple of weeks ago at the Morris Graves Museum, and maybe we should just start by telling me a little bit about how you two came to know one another and why you chose to do a reading together.
Basically, I had a crazy idea one day to do a reading. I've hadn't done one in a long time. I've sort of taken a hiatus from publicly reading, and called up the Morris Graves, and they were very receptive to the idea, and I wanted to do it with someone because I was rather nervous about doing it, and Neil is a good friend of mine, and he was very happy to do it with me, and I knew he had a new book out that he wanted to get in front of people, and it was a wise choice because he has a lot of people who love his work, and they came out in droves, thankfully, and he carried the day. And it was a very good day, wouldn't you say, Neil?
Absolutely, and I'd like to add that when James and I worked at the Times Standard, our desks were separated by about 12 feet of space, but technically we sat next to each other in the newsroom.
That's true. I could smell him from 12 feet away.
OMG.
Well, working in a newsroom myself, I find that swearing helps a whole lot when I'm working. So I wonder, because of the generational difference between you two, James, did you learn any cool, exciting new swear words from Neil when you were working together?
Well, I don't know, because it's hard to understand what he says. When he gets really angry, his New York accent gets so bad that it kind of just jumbles together.
Hey, you got a problem with that? Forget about it.
I do know that other employees would often disappear with something about concrete shoes. I don't know. You know, they disappear into the bay. He's got some gangster connections. I know that.
But. We tried you know, finding ourselves at the sports desk, I got a quarter for every cuss word, but it didn't even last hours. You know, the pot was too large and no one was going to be able to pay.
Yeah. We've both spent many years, though, in the Times Standard toiling away in the salt mines. It was a windowless, they used to call it the news tomb. The second floor of the Times Standard building, they're not there anymore, though, right? They moved downstairs.
They are, but yeah. On YouTube is still the photo of the video.
The dog.
The earthquake that
yes.
took place, and I was one of the last people to leave the newsroom. I kind of wrote it out upstairs. And
yeah. Let me set the scene for you. There was a big earthquake, but I think what you see is the dog first, right?
Dog.
Yes.
Yeah. Alerted to it.
Yeah. So there's a dog sitting there, and you see the dog run off. Right?
Followed by Chris Durant.
And then the room starts shaking like crazy because there's obviously a big earthquake. But the
tiles were flapping up and down. And
yeah. And then later that night, we had to produce the paper, but we did it from
the loading dock.
The loading dock downstairs, yes, and
people
laptops.
Holding flashlights over people typing on laptops.
Yeah. And in fact, we had to print the paper from the competitors. At the time, the Eureka Reporter's printing press out in Samoa, which was a bit of an indignity, but we got it done, and it's kind of a champion moment, as I recall. We felt pretty
yes.
good about all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That sounds very hectic. Having
yeah.
Working for a weekly, we do have our hectic day, you know, every Tuesday.
Yeah.
But dailies are a whole different thing. You got to get the news out every day, no matter what.
Yeah. You know, that deadline, it's a rush of adrenaline, you know, kind of keeps you going, keeps you moving.
I think newspaper writing lends itself to fiction writing because you are getting at least two people to read it, so you're getting instant critique on your work, and you have to refine it, and there are deadlines, and tomorrow you have to do it all over again with something different, so you can't really look back and say, boy, that was a poor column I wrote or a bad story. And you can't just pat yourself on the back and try and ride the tide from yesterday. You have to do it again today. So I think being exposed to critical feedback on a daily basis kind of knocks out the grandiosity that some people might have if they just weren't showing their writing to anybody.
I think that's a good point. I think also it can be hard to switch from having that daily feedback to doing fiction writing, in that when you don't have the feedback, it's almost like you lose the drive a little bit. I mean, it's like when you're doing like a longer project or something creative and you don't have someone breathing down your neck or looking over your shoulder, and you don't have that constant, I don't want to say, you know, pat on the head or whatever. You don't have that constant like affirmation. But if you don't, it's like you're not, I don't know, you don't feel like the satisfaction kind of sometimes. So it's important to develop the discipline that you need to for the payoff in the long run. Like, that's something I've had to work on. I have a column that I write. I've kind of taken a short hiatus as I've been editing and working on other stuff recently. But I had to go out and find something, since I haven't been writing at the paper, to give me that satisfaction, because without it, it's you can fall off. Without that need for, or without that satisfaction of having someone there all the time to tell you you're doing good work, or to tell you when you're doing something wrong, or just to help you out and give you some eyes and ears on your work, it's it can be troublesome.
Tell people where they can find your column and what it's called.
Yeah, it's Lost Coast Outpost. I write Dead Reckoning. I haven't published in a few weeks. I've been doing some editing. I'm working on a longer project, and I've been working on some fiction. I've been on like about a month long hiatus, but on the Lost Coast Outpost, if you click on if you go to that website, it's under Dead Reckoning and their features link.
So I remember really clearly the first article I read of yours. I think it's one that you read at your recent reading. Saying read over and over again. Sorry, listeners. I write better than I talk. But I remember really clearly reading the first article that either you published on there, or just the first one that I read, where you talked about addiction. And I believe the words you used, which I may be remembering incorrectly, is that the children of the good people of Eureka are sitting under bushes and behind gas stations. That, paraphrasing poorly, I'm sorry, I should have looked it up.
Yeah, it was way cooler than that, but go ahead.
why don't you just tell me how I got it wrong, because it's really a beautiful sentence and I'm mangling it.
I don't remember.
it made a really big impression on me, because I don't remember reading something like that in our community about something that so strongly affected our community, which is addiction.
Yeah, the name of the piece was Addicts Among You, Yes You. The point of the piece was basically that there are addicts among everyone, and that they are your brothers and sisters, that they are living next to you, they're your kids, they're people you know. If they're not you, then they're people very close to you, and that if you just open your eyes and look closely, you can find them, and you need to stop pretending that they're not people you love. In full disclosure, I am a recovered or barely recovered, trying to recover heroin addict. I mean, people talk about recovery as a process. It's not something you ever achieve, contrary to what people might think. It's today I am sober. Today I'm clean. That's all I got. So it's a battle we fight. And people like to look down their noses at people who have problems like that. People like to judge. People like to think that it's some at some remove, and that you can judge people like that. But it's they have no right to do that, because they don't understand that the battle, or that the circumstances that brought that person to that point. It's fear. I mean, it's a disease, and it's just way more complicated than people can comprehend. And I think people just need to wake up to the fact that it's not something to judge. It's something that we need to bring compassion to bear on. I mean, I'm not really speaking very well, but that's how I feel about it.
Well, that was a very different kind of work than the work you were doing as a reporter. And I'm wondering what kind of reception you got and what it was like to put yourself out there and, you know, bear your personal experience like that.
The reception I got was fantastic. I mean, people were really welcoming. It's interesting, you know, put the story on the table. I was a journalist, and then I had this little problem, taking drugs, so I had to stop being a journalist. I did it. I quit the paper because I had a drug problem, and I went to rehab to try and take care of it, and it didn't take. So I obviously relapsed once I got out of rehab, and kind of waffled back and forth for a little while, and then I ultimately got arrested with a 20 sec a heroin on my person and a syringe, and kind of went through that for a little while. Went to jail. Not a fun place. Man, jail sucks. The orange jumpsuits are really uncomfortable, and everything smells like cleaner, like bleach. Anyway, lost my train of thought there for a second, because jail really sucks. But so I left the time standard to get away from it, so I wouldn't embarrass myself and I wouldn't embarrass the paper. Well, little did I know that when I got arrested, people were going to recognize my name as James Falk, and so the police department thought it would be a great idea to issue a press release saying that the former editor of the Time Standard got arrested for being a junkie. So it was a big news story. It was on the front page of the Journal and the Time Standard, and the first lead story on the Channel 3, and it's a huge deal. It blew up. My life fell apart. Like, in a month, my wife had left me, and not because it was an embarrassment to her, but because I was a total freaking mess. I was just a, I was a total, problem child. Very literally, a child. Anyway, so, things were going from bad to worse, and, I finally managed to get things cleaned up and whatnot. What was the question again?
It's the road to recovery is a long one. And I'm wondering, Neil, did this time overlap with your time at the Time Standard? Were you witness to this?
Yes. My experience was a little bit different, because I'd spent 19 years as a drug and alcohol counselor in our county, 10 years as the family and group counselor at Family Recovery Services Rehab at St. Joe's. And I was kind of aware that my neighbor had a problem, but didn't feel like it was my job to stick my nose in. And I figure when people are ready to ask for help, that sometimes they do.
He did make an interesting point to me the other day, where he, my last day there, I had talked to him in the parking lot, and I just decided to go to rehab, and I was leaving, and we had a conversation in the parking lot.
Yes.
And what would you say? Can you tell that story again, or do you remember how you put it to me?
I looked at you and realized you were high, and thought, well, he looks like
you put it a little bit more colorfully to me.
A little more colorfully, yeah. But it's a complex issue. I
laugh.
Come from a family with
it's not that
two
funny.
Brothers and five nephews who are police officers or detectives or lieutenants and retired, and it's a big issue. One of the things I liked most about rehab was working with the entire family, because you meet people from every walk of life. I think that's what you were hitting on there, was it's not any one segment of society, but and people, you say, is it a disease, it learned behavior? You know, personally, I don't give a damn. If you got a problem, you do something about it.
Yeah.
You can debate what it is, but if you have a problem, get some help.
Yeah.
So I just want to shout out to our listeners real quick that if you want to call in, the numbers are 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. You can also text Thursday Night Talk at 492-KHSU. I'm Linda Stansberry, and I'm interviewing James Falk and Neil Tarpey about writing, journalism, and addiction on the North Coast.
You know, one thought I had too, Linda, was my book has 52 short stories, and I've told people that, you know, it's about 13 of them are autobiographical, and some of those have to do with alcohol and drug use, and those tend to be the ones that some people have trouble with trouble reading. And when I've read some of them in public, there's kind of this pause, because some of them are pretty heavy about friends dying, or they're usually not happy happy stories of the 52, but that's part of the whole spectrum of life that I've experienced. And as you said, I'm glad you pointed out about Laura's drawings, because she's a fantastic artist, and I don't think that book would have gone very far at all without her talent illustrating 14 of those stories in the cover, and she did just a fantastic job.
Yes, she did. And I'm wondering, is there one that you'd like to read tonight? They're all very short. You won the 2009 Flash Fiction Prize from the Journal, I believe.
I did.
Against me, by the way. I also entered that contest. And just to let you know.
Well, they gave the edge to the older guy. What can I say?
I didn't realize it's encouraging that you guys managed to get past, you know, that old hurt there and that competitiveness, and
come
together tonight to be on the show.
Absolutely. In fact, we actually first met at CR when I was teaching a psychology class.
In fact, he
was the brilliant student in the front row.
Yeah. You did take an interest in my writing back then, and ever since, I've always been interested in your writing. Me to write.
I remember doing a New York thing. I'd roll down the window, it drives my wife nuts, roll down the window and yell at you as we went by, "Keep writing!"
Yeah, man. You've always been a support. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. You guys have continued to... your guys' lives have continued to run into one another.
Yeah, he's also a good friend of my uncle, and that's been part of the connection. He's a really, really good guy. Buy his book, people. I'm going to pull in a Kellyanne Conway. Buy his book.
I do have a story that I particularly like, and I'm wondering if you'll read this for our listeners.
Which one is this?
Ruby.
You just like this because you have dogs.
Hey,
I like it because
don't
I
have take
dogs
your love to town.
Because with most of your work, it says a lot in just a few words.
Would you be okay if I read this story about a dog instead?
Of course.
All right, for you dog lovers. This is called "The Beagle and the Hitman." "I'm a hitman. You got a problem with that?" Salami Sal kept screwing Guido's wife, so Uncle Rocco said, "Whack 'em both, make it messy." Two shotgun blasts in their motel room. "Forget about it." Baldini's chauffeur snitched him to the feds. "I guarded that driver in a garage." "Harvey embezzled union funds. I used a Nagant revolver with a silencer on him." "But leaving Harvey's home, I spotted a beagle on the porch. Big brown eyes, tail wagging, soft ears. Leave no witnesses," I thought, scooping up my little sweetheart. I heard Inspector Vulcan smiled when he spotted the empty dog bed.
I love that story, too, not just because I'm a dog lover, but also because I think that you accomplish a lot with just so little. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired that story?
You know, I love crime fiction and film noir, and I read a lot of crime writers, Joe Nesbo and Ken Bruin, and I'm a dog lover. I have two dogs right now. I have a little beagle, and I have a three-legged pit bull. I should say we have them. My wife and I adopted them. But so it seemed like I always thought about, do hitmen have a soft side? And did he ever, like, think about, aside from the people, what's going on? And so I put the dog in the story and kind of cramped it down to 100 words, and there it is.
Why did you choose to go with this flash fiction motif for your entire book?
I got hooked on it when James was talking about that first contest, and we were talking on the ride over here about keeping a chart of all the things we send out, and with all the rejections, you know, I think the rejections are at least probably 80% of any writer's life, and it's kind of nice when one gets out there and people like it or give you good feedback. So I kept writing him and writing him and writing him, and more were getting published in print or online, and we have publishers in our county here, John and Susan Daniels, who John was the one actually exposed me to the 55-word story in a class I took. So it felt pretty natural. It felt like condensing down into a poem. They say in flash fiction, every word has to fight for its survival. And I believe that you can't have many adverbs or adjectives, and you have to get right to the point and get the conflict and the character and the choices in there. And I like it. It's a challenge.
This is so nice because I rarely get to talk to fiction writers or creative writers, and as someone who's also an aspiring, hopefully future published fiction writer.
You have a fiction book right here on the table.
That's right. Yeah, I brought you a copy of my novel, and hopefully you'll be kind because I wrote it before I became a journalist, and so there's a lot of stuff that now when I look at it, I would just completely eradicate. But how do you deal with rejection? You get rejected so much when you're a fiction writer. Everything you send off your babies into the world, and some guy in, you know, a glass building in Ohio reads them and says, "Nope, not going to publish this." Like, how do you go on?
I'm going back to what I said earlier about the newsroom and being told to chop this out or cut that out, or we only have room for, you need to get rid of two paragraphs. And you have to just accept that not everyone's going to like everything that you read, that you write.
Yeah, and like my wife and I have been talking a lot about it. She's kind of my psychologist with this stuff, you know. She's like trying to train me up to deal with it, because I'm just now starting the whole submission process. I've been putting it in a drawer, publishing it at a paper or whatever, but never actively submitting it all. But you got to go through it. That's kind of how I feel about it. Like, you've got to get your stack of rejections before you can break through to the you know, the promised land. So I got to get my 200 rejections before I can get published, you know, where I want to be.
That's all. You know, I also get them. Sorry for interrupting you.
Yeah, Neil, that was really rude, man.
I didn't drink your coffee, at least.
There's a recovery metaphor.
You get a New Yorker
right
in the room, and then you start.
I was just going to say, the only way out is through, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So I would like to...
But now you're interrupting him.
I am interrupting Neil, and
no,
I am enjoying
we're moving
it to the
on.
Hilt.
We're moving on.
just because I want to give you a chance also to read the piece that you brought in, James. This is one that you finished your reading back in March with, and I think it's really wonderful. I'd like our listeners to hear it.
Okay, yes. It's called Taming the Beast. Thank you for asking me to bring it in. Taming the Beast. This was written, I used to work at the Sunrise Cemetery down in Fortuna, and this was written about that time, and as it would, it sort of occurred in 2015, just as the rains were ending, which is sort of like in a similar situation to where we're at now. It's like it's been a really wet year, and we were having a problem with mud collapsing in on the graves. It was a very problematic time for the sextons that year. The shortest days have passed, as has the majority of my life. Each year, despite notions to the contrary, defensive position assumed, and hope held aloft like a lantern in the dark, the fleeting sun drains me. This year has gone famously for my wife, for my family and me. There's work, good work that I enjoy, both on the page and off. And we have a new person teetering clumsily about the living room floor to learn, fall, cry, and rise again. I'm healthier than ever, and we live on a postcard that seems as if it's 1,000 miles from trouble, but only a 20-minute walk from Mayberry. My wife is beautiful, smart, and funny. She's adept at keeping me grounded and engaged, and the rest of my children are thriving, whole and well, smarter than me. Yet these low spring days so far seem bleak. We rise before the sun, slip into our thicker clothes, dodge the heavy sheets of rain between house and car, and do our daily duties under a slate-gray ceiling that stretches light thin, weakens our shadows, and does nothing to burn off yesterday's stink. I come from a gene pool fairly rotten with muck, a slimy top layer of mental illness, depression, melancholia, even schizophrenia. I'm familiar with these moods, and like a circus trainer armed with kitchen chair and bullwhip, I manage them as best I can. They snarl and quake at little more than an arm's length away most of the time. But when the dark fog stole settles over these coastal mountains, and the rain slants sideways in the damned wind, my pet tiger snaps its jaws and yet another chair leg flies off into the scrub, that much closer. When rainwater saturates the earth at the cemetery where I work, floods the drains and collapses fresh graves in on themselves, another leg lops off. When an old woman, cold and alone, writes out the check to bury her addicted granddaughter because no one cared to, then forgets her granddaughter's name, the tiger chomps that old wooden seat to splinters. When the sextons wrangle with the slosh of mud and sweat, deftly move their backhoes and long-handled shovels among tombstones to fruitlessly keep the soft walls from melting into the collapsing center, tired but enduring, for a service set to start in the morning, I throw what remains at the angry feline, cover my head, and wait. At night, it usually seems, the sun gathers strength from its rest. It may take a day, it may take 6 weeks, but always, and I mean always, it rallies at some point from its low ebb and emerges from the eastern curb of sky, blessed and bright, to beat the soggy demons back. And it is joy, I believe, at the sun's return that motivates the barn swallows and song sparrows, eight-legged ne'er-do-wells, even this blade-legged toad that roosted overnight on my desk to suddenly explode with life. And on that suddenly sunny day, I step outside and feel the sun burn away all the settled muck and crust on this heart's highways. I am resurrected. Not so, the granddaughter. Some winters never end. But the sun did dry the grass, and the guys, as usual, did work a minor miracle with machinery and hand tools, keeping the walls intact and pumping the grave free of mud and depravity as the family gathered that day to bury her. They grieved as the sky relented, and sometimes, often even, that's all we can ask.
Thank you. Powerful. That's really beautiful. So, I want to ask you a question about that, which is, first of all, how long did it take you to write it? And then, second of all, did you find yourself reaching for a resolution that felt less miserable than the beginning, that felt like it was an apex or a sense of optimism that you didn't feel at the time when you wrote it?
Okay, so the formula, it took me about an hour and a half to write. And then I walked away from it for about an hour, and then I edited it for about half an hour, and then I sent it to the Lost Coast.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually what I do for the column. And then I re-edited it for the reading, and then I did another edit for tonight. In terms of the mood, I think I like the lack of, I guess, what are you asking exactly about that? I mean, phrase the question again. I'm kind of not...
It's kind of a vague question, I have to admit. But I feel that a lot of the times when we're writing about heavy issues, yeah. we want to reach towards some conclusion that offers some sense of optimism.
Yeah.
I mean, even the optimism in this is kind of bleak, right?
Yeah.
But do... And I can throw this out to Neil, too. Do you guys ever find yourself reaching for an optimism or reaching for a conclusion that you don't necessarily feel is there just to resolve that narrative cycle?
This poem, I'm saying, this piece is about surviving.
Mm-hmm.
It's about survival being the only hope at this, and I say it's a column, so yes, it's biographical, but at the same time, it's a persona, right? Like, this is narrative nonfiction, but it's like I'm adopting, it's a character at the same time. Like, and like, I don't know, am I admitting something I shouldn't be admitting? I don't know. Like, there's, it's not like I'm, for the purpose of the piece, for it to be cohesive, there are times when I am not actively, how do I, you know, I don't know. It's like, there are, it's like, do I necessarily feel that bleak all the time? No. In that particular moment, was it like, was I that dark? Not necessarily, but for that piece in that moment, the message I was, I guess, I mean, I don't know what I'm, it's like I didn't necessarily, I'm talking myself in circles. I'm rambling. Forget it. Take all that back. Forget you people. I'm going home.
Don't leave. You can't leave. Neil's your ride. What do you think, Neil?
I think you can't force an ending to either be happy just to make people happy or sad. It just has to be a feeling of being genuine, truthful, true to yourself, true to what you're writing. Now, I know people have read some of my stories and said, you know, the ending would have been better if you had blah, blah, blah. Well, then that's the ending to their version of it, or their story, but that isn't necessarily the ending to the one I wrote.
Yeah, it's like in the moment that felt perfect, and it still feels perfect. When I read it out loud, that's like the ending that needed to be there for that particular piece. I read it and it gives me chills. I mean, I don't know. I love it.
I'm so glad you admitted that, because sometimes I read things that I've wrote and I get the same thing. And I don't think it's necessarily an ego thing. I think it's just like, you know, when you're on a hot streak, you know?
Yeah, and it resonates for you. And that's why you wrote it. I mean, it's not like I don't think it's the best piece of work ever written. But for me, I'm like, I like it. I wrote it. That's why I wrote it. You know, what the hell? HE double toothpicks. Sorry, FCC.
I think we're good. Do you guys have favorite writers, favorite influences?
Absolutely. Go ahead, Neil.
Well, I as I said, I read a lot of crime writers. I like Joe Nesbo. I like Ken Bruin. Stuart Neville, The Ghosts of Belfast is one of my favorite books. Ian McKinty, James Lee Burke is like, you know, to me, he's like a national treasure. I've read probably 20 of his novels, and I was quite a fan of Jim Harrison. I was first introduced to him on this campus when Judith Minty, who was a poet in residence here, told me I should read everything of his I could find. And
you met Judith Minty?
Judith Minty was my poetry teacher, yeah.
And that's cool.
So I started reading Jim Harrison, and some people know he passed away last year, but I was really proud because my wife belongs to a book club, and they picked one of his books, Dalva, as this is an all-women's book club, the 10 or 12 women, and that's what they read 2 months ago. So I like to think I exerted a subtle influence by leaving that book around the house. That's my story. I'm sticking to it.
What about you, James?
You know, I like Raymond Carver. We were talking about that today, and I was...
He lived up here.
He did live up here.
Yeah.
Yes. Humboldt State University...
English student.
And then he went to Chico State to graduate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hung out at the Jambalaya. Awesome. A guy named... Simmons. Dan Simmons is actually a kind of a Pulp Fiction guy. He writes a lot of science fiction and also horror, but he's actually a fantastic writer. Cormac McCarthy, he's amazing. No Country for Old Men. He also wrote The Road and a lot of other great books. I like Stephen King.
I love Stephen King.
Yes. There are some you know, bad books thrown in there, but there's also some amazing books, and he's just good at telling a story. You can fall into a bunch of his books.
You know, jumping off Stephen King real quick to talk about the writing process. Have you read his book On Writing?
I haven't read that one yet.
Oh, my gosh.
Is it good?
Oh, it's so good. If you're a writer, you really should. You should read it. And one of the things he says is he talks about, you know, writing, the difference between writing when you have that flash of inspiration and then just like the day-to-day brick and mortar, just like put one foot in front of another writing.
Yeah.
And he has a philosophy that, you know, you don't always get up and like get inspired and like sit in front of your computer and have those like, you know, forgive me, flashes of lightning, right? But sometimes you just need to get there and
see
do
where she's going with that.
And just do the workman's job of showing up, even if you think it's terrible, which I did that a lot when I finished this book that you have.
Yeah.
Ugh. Like, sometimes I still look through it, and I'm like, yeah, I was
called
not
called the Trinidad Mystery, by the way.
Yes, yes. It's a mystery novel set in Trinidad called The Trinidad Mystery. It's very literal. what do you guys think? Is it inspiration or perspiration or both?
It's a combination of the two, right? I mean, it's got to be. I think that it's got to be hard work, and it's got to be inspiration. There's no...
I have a card that I sent to myself on my desk, and it says 10% perspiration, 10% inspiration, 80% caffeination.
Yeah, I definitely believe that.
You know, an interesting thing I heard Stephen King talk about was his process is mostly laying in bed at night. He was saying that how he plots his novels and how he basically dreams his books up is that at night when he goes to bed, he lays there before he goes to sleep and he thinks about his books, and he basically just considers and like daydreams before he goes to sleep what he'll have happen in his books, and like it really provides the fodder for things. Like I'm working on a short story now. And I haven't been writing fiction, but because I figured out this, Neil and I have been talking lately, and there's this application/program, whatever the hell you want to call it.
Go back to Stephen King.
Yeah, anyway, Stephen King. He says that he lays in bed and thinks about this stuff, and it works. It really works, folks. I'm telling you, 1995. You too can have it.
Shawshank Redemption.
Shawshank Redemption.
Excellent. Well, great. We actually have to finish up for the night, but I want to throw it out again at our listeners. Neil Tarpey's book, Flashes of Lightning, with illustrations by Laura Sarzan-Jones. Where can people pick this up?
In Arcata at Northtown Books, in Eureka at Booklegger in Old Town, Eureka Books in Old Town, Pacific Paper in Henderson Center, Blake's Books in McKinleyville, and... our friends online at Amazon sell a lot of them.
Excellent. So Neil Tarpey, last name spelled like Tarp with an E-Y.
And I like it that you pronounce it right. People sometimes say Tarpey, and I go,
Tarpey.
And then I have to tell them about the Irish, you know, the Kellys, the Murphys, anything ending in Y is probably Irish.
I like Tarpey. I think you should go with it.
Yes, yes. Let's give Neil a hard time. And then James Falk, last name is spelled like Faulkner without the ner.
Or like it's my fault.
Yes. And your work can currently be found in the Lost Coast Outpost, soon to be famous somewhere else as well, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, someday.
So thank you guys both so much for being on tonight, and thank you to all of our listeners here on Thursday Night Talk, and to our engineer, the wonderful Michael Roccaforte.
Thank you, Linda. You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks again to our host, Linda Stansberry, and our guests, James Falk and Neil Tarpey. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Coming up next week on Thursday Night Talk, Eric Kirk and HSU professor Matthew Derrick talk about Russia and how we got from the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union to Putin's Russia. Tune in and join the conversation on April 13th, beginning at 7. Thanks to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next. It's 8 o'clock.